Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the head of public engagement at the museum. Object Matters is a podcast in which we get our guests to reflect upon their personal connection with an object or a series of objects in the museum collection. And I'm very excited for this particular episode because my guest is archaeologist Dr. Joseph Lerner, or Seppi, as everyone knows you, from the University of Sydney's Archaeological Department in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. Together, today, we're going to travel to the ancient Middle East. So, Seppi, welcome.
Thank you very much, Craig. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on Object Matters. I guess I'm actually really excited to hear your impressions on the object that we're focusing on today, or I should say series of objects, actually. Mm-hmm. But I guess before we take a deep dive into the topic today, can I ask you to talk to our listeners a bit about your own research interests and your career before you actually came to Sydney as well?
Yeah, so I think like a lot of folks, such as myself in archaeology, it goes way back to being a kid. A lot of that has to do with going to museums as a kid. But really, my career in archaeology started as an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, where I studied under Mark Kanoyer, who at the time was excavating at Harappa in Pakistan. But given the time as it was, I didn't really have the opportunity to do much work in Pakistan. It was very difficult to travel there. And so what I ended up doing is actually my first experience in archaeology was in, of all places, so far from the Middle East, in Alaska. I spent two seasons as an undergraduate in Alaska at a paleoarctic site called Swan Point. And it's a fascinating time. But immediately after that, I took on a scholarship to go to the American University in Cairo, really to study Arabic, but also ancient Egyptian archaeology, art, and culture. And it was during that course of a sort of year of time that I took on an opportunity to go to Turkey, a place that I'd been already as a teenager. And the first project really was the site of Kerkenes Dağ. It was the first project that I ever worked on in the Middle East. It's a site that I now co-direct, of all things, which is a fascinating sort of development. So I've been working there for about 16 years. And so previous to coming to Sydney, I had spent already quite a bit of time in Turkey, or ancient Anatolia, working at Kerkenes, Tel Tainat, the Halaf site of Domuztepe with my PhD advisor, Liz Carter. And for the bulk of my dissertation research, I worked at Boazköy Hattusa, the site of the ancient Hittite capital. And from there, it really fluoresced. I've worked in Syria and most recently in Oman before coming here.
I want to follow up a little bit on Oman because that's your other major current fieldwork project.
That's right.
Well, obviously, at the moment, with COVID and travel restrictions, like all archaeologists, we're a little bit grounded, aren't we, at the moment?
We sure are.
The reason why, I mean, obviously, we could have a episode in future quite specifically about your work in Turkey, but given the object that we're focusing on today, the work you're doing in Oman has a real connection, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah. So Oman being at the very southeastern sort of tip of the Arabian Peninsula and also situated really strategically in the Persian Gulf region and the Indian Ocean writ large, it fits itself geographically between the Indus Valley and Mesopotamia. And that is, of course, very important for the development of societies in that region in terms of interregional interconnections and that sort of thing. But also Oman is a region that has one of the largest reserves of copper in, say, Western Asia at large, very similar to what we see in Cyprus, for example, the Southern Levant and other places in Anatolia and Iran.
Yeah.
Oman has a massive reserve of copper, several very important sites, and many of which go back 5,000 years.
Right, right. Now, I know we will continue to weave the story in, but I guess let's bring the Nicholson Collection object into the discussion right now. What item, well, indeed, actually a series of items, really, but what items from the Chow Chak Wing Museum Collection have you chosen today for us to talk about?
Well, so the object, or a series of objects that I wanted to talk about today are one of the, actually, the collection of objects, one of the first collection of objects that I saw while visiting here in 2018 for the first time. And I zoomed straight to them. They are these copper alloys. It's a collection of copper alloys from the Royal burial of, or the royal cemeteries of Ur, the very important regional center of southern Mesopotamia, Sumeria. These objects represent in and of themselves a suite of copper alloys, mostly weapons, but also pins and needles and fragments of vessels and things like this that come from this cemetery context. And these objects form, or really are represented by, tens of thousands of objects that came from this particular cemetery. So it's really great that they're here to see.
Well, we'll talk more about the excavations in a moment. But I guess, the image that we're using on the website is of one of the axe heads. I wonder if you could describe it to our listeners. But then, I mean, you talked about sort of the wide variety of the copper allied items that have been manufactured, from weapons to tools and so on as well. I guess maybe just sort of talk about some of the ones that we do actually have here in Sydney.
Sure.
And you know, what they actually look like.
Right. Well, the one object on display, which again is a suite of objects that are on display in the museum today that you can go and see, is a kind of shaft hole axe of a very typical type. Many of these kinds known to Western Asia, spread from basically Anatolia all the way down to Southern Arabia. It itself is produced using a kind of casting technology, probably a 2 or 3 part mold. And it's produced of an unknown alloy. We might refer to these kinds of materials as bronze, but we really don't know. It could be an alloy of copper and tin, which is a whole really great and exciting topic to discuss or to talk about. But it could also be an arsenical copper, which was probably the most common type of alloy at that time. And beyond all of those sort of recipes, there's a suite of other really interesting kind of characteristics to this particular axe. One of the most interesting, perhaps, is that within the shaft itself remains preserved some of the original wooden part of the handle that's there, probably pseudomorphed in the corrosion.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting you point that out, because that is actually one of the things many of the visitors to the museum actually comment upon when they see this particular object as well. I want to talk more about the archaeological context in a moment, but it's interesting when you talk about with copper alloys, but not necessarily being able to determine the actual chemical composition without scientific analysis. One of the interesting things in the time since these objects were excavated back in the 1920s and early 1930s, of course, there's been huge leaps in archaeometallurgical investigations. I wondered if you could kind of give our listeners a bit of an overview in terms of some of the revolutions that's actually happened, particularly more recent decades, in terms of the way that we can actually analyze and attempt to understand the makeup of some of these metal objects from antiquity.
Absolutely. So archaeometallurgy as a field has been around for several decades, as you mentioned, and it really is a kind of scientific borrowing from departments of engineering and mining and all that, and really had its main innovations as a field in Germany. And with that being said, the field has, like you say, has really seen a huge impulse of activity recently, not only because of just the rise in archaeological science more generally, but also the understanding that metal as a material, because it's so complex and arguably one of the most complex kind of materials in terms of its just the material makeup, but also the technology involved, really makes for a really important marker in understanding social processes. We can understand a lot of things about society just by understanding how metal is produced and made.
Well, trade for one.
Trade,
which we'll come back to in a moment, but also, of course, obviously, I guess, production techniques and uses of materiality, among other things, aren't there?
That's right, yeah. And what's really great about the Ur materials is that it's actually quite, the copper alloys that come from this site are really woven nicely into the origins of archaeometallurgy as a discipline. Already in the 1920s, and really based in London and the UK for the most part, but involving a network of scholars, they were already quite interested in the fact that there are not only metals in southern Mesopotamia, a region where there are no natural occurring metal or ores or anything like this, metal resources.
Yep.
And so they wanted to really study these metals to figure out principally where they were coming from.
Yeah.
And so they used techniques that were common to them in spectroscopy to analyze some of these metals, not the ones that are on display at the Chow Chuk Wing Museum, but others that had made their way to London and also to Pennsylvania. Mm. The so-called Sumerian Copper Committee really spent quite a lot of time trying to understand these things. And so they were already pretty quickly able to figure out the kinds of alloys that were present, whether arsenical copper or tin bronzes. But one of the other most fascinating things that they discovered is that the impurities in the copper really provided some tantalizing clues about where the metal may have been coming from.
Okay, let's leave it at that point because we'll talk more about where they may have been coming from a little bit later on. But I guess let's talk a little bit more about the archaeological context, because here in Sydney we have a handful of these objects, but you said there were thousands that were found during the excavations at the Royal Cemetery at Ur. Could you talk more about the Royal Cemeteries generally? Because they were very significant archaeological excavations, but also given their time frame, the projects, the excavations by Sir Leonard Woolley were taking place in the 1920s, also really captured the world's imagination for a number of reasons. I wonder if you could kind of talk a bit about the processes of Woolley's excavations, what they were finding, and then the cemetery themselves and the interpretation of the cemeteries.
That's right. Yeah, it's a wonderful part of the history of archaeological practice in Western Asia, in Iraq in particular. When Leonard Woolley made his way to Iraq, he already had quite a background in archaeology at that point in time, having worked with Lawrence of Arabia, as it were, in Carchemish in what's now southeastern Turkey, and before that having worked in Italy and in the UK on Roman period sites.
And in Egypt, too.
And in Egypt as well, yeah. In Sudan, he spent some time there. Really a great diverse background. By the time he made it to Ur, which was really sort of an assignment from the British Museum and the University of Pennsylvania, he made it there with the kind of task to excavate in a very, very large fashion, in a way that excavations no longer occur today. We're talking hundreds of employees that worked with him from the local communities there. And over through the course of about 12 seasons of excavation there across a lot of this site. And by the way, Ur is a massive archaeological site. And before he made his way and discovered the cemeteries, he actually did quite a lot of clearance of the ziggurat of Ur, the sort of tower temple of Ur. It was took basically the first third of the 12 seasons. He spent his time clearing off this ziggurat before finally moving eventually into an area by accident in some ways, finding the first of the cemeteries in, I believe, 1926. And it was from there he devoted the entire attention to these cemeteries. And in the first season that he spent time on these cemeteries, he already excavated about 300 separate interments, separate burials as they were, recognizing already early on that these burials offered a really important window into the development of this city, because he already had an idea that from the material culture, these burials had a stratigraphic relationship and the material culture changed over time, all of which kind of existed within this so-called early dynastic period of time. And so, again, through the course of, I believe, four separate seasons with a focus on the cemetery, they excavated, I think, somewhere around 1,500 to 1,800 separate burials, 16 of which were monumental in form. And it was from these monumental discoveries that he called it the Royal Cemetery of Ur.
And of course, it really did capture the world's imagination. This was only a number of years after Tutankhamun's tomb being uncovered. And so, of course, there was already a media ready to soak up the stories. Ur, with its biblical connotations, for better or worse, of course, also gave it a certain degree of pre-awareness. And one of the most famous participants in the excavations, of course, has helped mythologize it in many ways. And this, of course, is Agatha Christie.
That's right. She was there in the second season, as far as I understand.
Yeah.
And that's where she also met Max Mallowan as well, before they went off to Nimrud.
And of course, the excavations themselves and some of the archaeologists became the basis of some of the characters in her novel Murder in Mesopotamia, which is also an interesting read in terms of understanding a little bit about some of the Dig politics, I suspect, as well, albeit fictionalized. But it really was a significant excavation. In terms of this early dynastic period of Ur, what time frame are we looking at?
So we're looking at basically the 3rd millennium BC. This is a time period that in Western Asia writ large, this is kind of referred to as the early Bronze Age. The early dynastic period in Mesopotamia, and in particular we're talking southern Mesopotamia, the land of Sumeria. This was an area that already by this point in time people had known that there was an urban tradition, but they didn't know how extensive, and they didn't know how far-reaching and how really to define it. It really took some progress in theory and understanding of Mesopotamia at this time to go forward with a lot of that. But they knew already that by this crucial period of time in the 3rd millennium BC, which is the same time as Old Kingdom Egypt, it's the same time that you see the important sites in central Turkey as well popping up as in this kind of urban tradition. And so it fits into this greater regional phenomenon of really complex societies.
Yes.
And the early dynastic period, through the work of Woolley and others at different sites, particular Kish being one of those, they were able to understand, with the help of cuneiform texts, which were coming out of excavations at this from these different sites, that this early dynastic period is represented really by a suite of cooperating and competing urban centers, city-states, as it were. They were never unified at this point in time, really under a single kind of state in Mesopotamia. That very rarely actually ever happens.
Yeah.
Though state-level organization, we know, was going on at this point in time. What's fascinating is that immediately after this early dynastic period of time is when you get the well-known period of Sargonid Mesopotamia, the time of Sargon of Akkad, when you do get this first sort of territorial state emerging for the first time.
Right.
So the early dynastic is setting the stage for a kind of sort of geopolitics that really mark a tradition of Mesopotamian, say, political behavior through millennia.
Mm. Okay. I mean, I guess one of the complexities that you're referring to that was revealed through the excavations on this scale too was the social stratification as represented by those different burials, from the very, very wealthy ones right through to far more common, for want of a better word, interments. What were some of the things that were being found by Woolley and his contemporaries in both the richer tombs and in the simpler tombs?
That's right. So you're absolutely right in saying that there is this great, say, social diversity represented in these burials through the course of the hundreds of years that it was used as a place. From the simplest burials, you will find, well, all the burials, it's pretty common to find, say, grave goods that were associated with them. In the simplest burials, you will find coarse wares, different kinds of ceramic pottery and this sort of thing, with the occasional metal tools and the like there, to all the way through to the most grand of the burials, which aren't just simple burials as they were. These were full structures that were built for these individuals and then buried. And in those structures, some of which have more than one room associated with it, you would have scores of different kinds of objects. So it's really rich material culture. And together with those, famously, other individuals that were buried with the singular elite individuals who were also buried there. And it's a source of much contention about who those additional individuals were, where they were coming from, whether these were slaves, for example, or these were people who were sacrificed. It's a very complex story.
And there's been, of course, a really radical reassessment of Woolley's initial interpretations, too, in more recent years, based upon forensic investigation of the human remains as well, too, which is really interesting. And one of the fascinating things, of course, is as an excavation in the 1920s, also the context of which, you know, Woolley and his contemporaries would have not batted an eyelid of the concept of someone laying down their life for an imperial figurehead, having seen so many of their contemporaries do so during World War One,
right.
Only a few years before as well too. So it's interesting how much of interpretation, archaeological interpretation, is a bias of our own times, isn't it?
I think that's right. Yeah. That's an interesting aspect of this. Yeah.
So, of course, among the more famous objects that have been found in the royal tombs that are now dispersed across the Iraq Museum and the British Museum and the University of Pennsylvania's Museum, who were the foreign project managers on the excavation. Mm-hmm. But, we've got things like the Royal Standard. So, of course, some of these objects have become so, so famous and so, so iconic, but they're only one small part of a much larger picture, aren't they?
They sure are, yeah. And, I mean, obviously you have the Royal Standard of Ur, which is at the British Museum. One can see this object there. This being a very important object in not only in art history terms and in helping sort of define the diversity of individuals that we see in these burials, but the kind of iconography that you see on that particular object really points to the variety of life, really the social world of the Sumerians at that time, and also importantly shows hints and elements of a kind of military organization as well, which is important because this is something that theoretically has been in much debate about when organized warfare happens. And so this is in this time period that you start seeing this come out in some ways for the first time.
Right. Bringing it back to these particular copper alloy objects in Sydney that have had a really long journey from Iraq to the British Museum before being sent out to Australia in 1935. But you talked before about there being thousands of metal objects found during the excavations. Was there a social stratification associated with metal, with these objects only being found in the higher social status burials, or was there a more wider distribution of metal objects across the whole range of graves?
It's a great question, and one that's really hard to tie, I think, one-to-one. That is, you know, if metal is present, therefore you have some aspect of status associated with that. But I think the general trend would be is that those burials that had more of a particular kind of thing, or a diversity of a particular kind of material, including metal. The idea is that this is associated with status.
Yeah.
And what's especially interesting is that these kinds of materials, when we figure out where they're coming from, it's also showing in some ways indirect alliances to particular regions and indirect access or direct access to these important economic networks and trade networks and things
mines
like this.
And processing.
That's right. Yeah.
Facilities. Which I guess brings us back to Oman and your own research. What are you finding in terms of the new research being done in the area, which actually has links with places like Mesopotamia?
Great.
Are there any direct links, or is
there? There absolutely are direct links, and it's one of the, I think, one of the most fascinating and also one of the more challenging things about doing work in Oman. If you contrast the archaeology of Oman and what we know of societies, especially during the Bronze Age in Oman, with Mesopotamia, what you have is not only a disparity in the archaeological evidence, since work in Oman is fairly recent and we don't have a lot of data and we don't have all the cities of Mesopotamia and all that.
Yes.
Most information is coming out of burial contexts in Oman, although there is a kind of urban tradition during this time in Oman. We just don't know very much about it.
Right.
Now, that being said, the kind of work that we're doing is directly trying to tackle this issue of chronology and the organization of production of metal, because we know there are hints, again, of where this metal is going over time, whether to the Indus Valley locally, is being locally consumed in Oman, or going up the Persian Gulf into Mesopotamia. And one of the first hints, like we were talking about earlier with the early work already in the 1920s, when they were doing these first analyses of these objects and doing, you know, understanding the chemistry of these objects, they were finding impurities. And one of those impurities turns out to be a pretty significant amount of nickel, the element nickel, or the metal nickel. And after they compared their, you know, simple analyses already to known copper sources across Western Asia at that time, which wasn't very extensive, they could already start to rule out certain places that weren't rich with this one particular metal. And already in 1928, I believe, they surmised that perhaps with the comparison of one ore source in Oman, which was rich in nickel, they already suggested in the 1920s that Oman might be where a lot of this metal was coming
from.
That's
interesting.
And what's particularly interesting about that is that it tied really nicely with cuneiform text at the time, in particular a well-known text that dates to around the time of Sargon of Akkad. This one period right after the early dynastic period, where they're talking about at the shores of Ur, the boats from many different regions would be moored, and there would be individuals from these locations coming into these cities, paying tribute, of course, to the kings of whatever city and whatever king. And one of these locations that was mentioned is Magan. And it require and there's another one, Malucha, which is these Magan and Malucha figures pretty prominently in these texts. And we now know that Magan almost certainly is Oman.
Yeah.
And Malucha is South Asia, the Indus Valley.
Right. That's really wide distribution then too, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Connectivity. That is fascinating just in terms of how, you know, those impurities can be traced and how they might lead to a much bigger picture. But I guess bringing it back to these particular pieces in the Chow Chak Wing Museum, how do you find yourself responding to them each time you see them? I mean, is there a, obviously there's an intellectual curiosity based upon your own work in Oman and your own interests, but is there anything that you find yourself responding to each time you see them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's coming from my training as a graduate student back at UCLA in the Getty, where my one of my committee members on my PhD always referred to these the objects as his sort of the patients that he would be working on.
Yeah.
and in some ways, while I don't maybe have that kind of relationship with these objects, I do look at them singularly. And there's just already, even looking through the vitrine in a museum, you can see so many characteristics from the patination kinds of patterns that you see in color and corrosion to the textures. Just even by standing, without even touching some of these objects, you can gain so much in just that way. So I see these objects as really the kind of materialization of a life history of these objects,
yeah,
in a sense,
yeah,
from their production all the way up into their deposition and display. It's really fascinating.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned before, too, about the traces of the wood that's still visible on the axe head as well. But, I mean, it's a wonderfully evocative in terms of the process of manufacture, isn't it? The two very different elements that have been brought together to create a usable weapon, in this case, but, you know, a usable tool.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the other thing. When looking at these objects, you're really, just as you say, you're looking at many different materials that were brought together to produce them. And so while from these we don't know yet, you know, exactly if they're produced of a tin copper alloy or bronze or if they're arsenical copper or some other alloy, which is certainly possible, nevertheless, these materials are synthetic.
Yep.
Right, and so people are intentionally making these. The materials that we see on display aren't just a simple kind of metal or whatnot. They're really bridging materials that are coming in from many different places. So, for example, if they're tin bronzes, the copper may very well be coming from Oman. It could also, we know through scientific analysis, that another possibility is Iran or Anatolia.
Yeah.
Or indeed, the copper coming from as far as Rajasthan in India.
Yeah.
There's evidence today that suggests that that might be possible. And so that's great. That's the copper. But to harden that copper and to make that copper look more like gold or have this beautiful golden sort of shine, you would add tin. And that tin, we don't know where it can be coming from. This is a big mystery, though it's likely that at this point in time, and this is right around the time that tin bronze was first innovated in the world, and it's very likely that that tin itself is coming from as far as Afghanistan. And so this one object, which we know comes from a cemetery in southern Iraq, has within it already direct evidence of long-distance trade connecting all these different regions, potentially. And it's through scientific analysis, of course, that we can verify these hypotheses, but that's that.
The question I'm asking everyone who appears on the podcast, and I should have warned you in advance I was going to do this one, but I guess if you could choose one word to describe what, you know, something like the axe head signifies to you, what would that word be?
Let me think about that. Okay. The word I think that I would choose is, I think, a way that it's already been borrowed from colleagues who've worked in India when they talk about craft production. And they talk about virtuous craft production, or a certain element of virtuosity to craft production. I think that's when I look at an object like this, which encapsulates in with it a depth of knowledge of production. No, you can't just learn how to do this in a day.
Yes.
You know, and the materials and where they're all coming from, that we're looking at a kind of craft production that has an element of virtuosity to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what I would, the word that I would choose for an object like this.
I like that. That's a very good word. Thank you, Seppi.
Of course.
Now, of course, three of the copper alloy objects, including the axe head, are currently displayed in the Chow Chak Wing Museum in our Ancient Cultures of the Middle East exhibition, along with another set of objects from Ur that were presented by the British Museum in 1935, including some ceramic items and shells and so on. Mm-hmm. When visitors go into that exhibition and they see these metal objects, what would you like them to think about when they're viewing?
I think one of the best things that these objects tell us are the... One, not only, like we discussed, the depth of connection that these people had already as long as 5,000 to 4,000 years ago had interregionally, but also these individuals and the people who cared for the dead and really endowed their burials with these materials are displaying in many ways a modern kind of behavior that we see even today. And so when looking at these old objects, we can, I think, see ourselves in them. With not too much thought, really, to have that sort of personal, almost compassionate, sympathetic response to these sort of objects.
That's a lovely way to end. Thank you, Seppi. You've taken us from ancient Mesopotamia to the Arabian Gulf to the Indus Valley and also through scientific analysis, modern scientific analysis. Very much appreciate you joining us on Object Matters. Thank you, Seppi.
A great pleasure, Craig. Thank you.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney acknowledges the traditional owners, and we pay our respect to elders past, present, and emerging. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.